Welcome. This year at the Zen Center, we're talking a lot about compassion and living to benefit all beings. It's a big topic. It's a difficult practice. Of course, we all want to be kind to others and not be harmful. I think we're probably all doing that to some extent. Those of us who practice a spiritual path, we know about this for a long time, and we're more aware of it maybe than those who don't pay much attention to their spiritual life. But nevertheless, I think it's still, when we hear about the Bodhisattva's vow to alleviate the suffering of all living beings, it's just beyond awesome. It's intimidating. Is that really even possible? And I think the main thing it comes down to is the feeling that, like, in our heart, the feeling that others are really not separate from us, that our well-being is really not more important than others. That's a big one, right? I mean, we've heard it many, many times, but to actually experience life that way, I think it doesn't just come naturally, and it doesn't come easily for anyone, I don't think. So thus we have a practice. We have teachings and practices to help us. Teachings kind of point in the general direction, and then the more we can understand them and remember them again and again, our mind can start to shift, right? Gradually, I think very gradually, our view of how things are can change. So one of the great Buddha Dharma teachers in this world, speaking about the Bodhisattva path, is Shantideva. Shantideva lived in India in the 7th century, and particularly regarding the teachings about compassion, kindness, and bodhicitta, Shantideva is like considered like the greatest. This is Shantideva's book, The Way of the Bodhisattva. For example, on the cover here it says, there's a quote by the Dalai Lama. And he says, if I have any understanding of compassion and the practice of the Bodhisattva path, it is entirely on the basis of this text that I possess it. That's quite an advertisement. Dalai Lama's compassion is completely based on Shantideva. So this, particularly in chapter 8 here, which is a chapter on meditative concentration, interestingly. But this is where Shantideva is really bringing up the this issue about self and other, this basic problem of it seems like there's an other. We'll never really be able to treat them as ourselves. Now we know that self and other are like completely interdependent. Like, we can't actually survive more than a few hours, at least when we're first born, right, without the kindness and support of others. And then throughout our whole life, we're completely dependent on others in a way that's easy to forget. Right? Every time we eat something, every time we drink water from a faucet, every time we have a warm place to sleep on a cold night, this is all due to others, the support of others, right? Who may not be thinking, I'm going to benefit beings by building a house or installing some plumbing, but in fact, they are. Yeah. Everybody all day long is offering something to others and receiving something from others. And that way we're completely dependent on others. This in itself, this kind of obvious truth, I feel is like well worth remembering. To kind of remember that again and again actually can start to change and shift the mind. That's why we have verses and things in Zen, like in our meal chant before eating, we say, innumerable labors brought us this food. And if we think of that and remember it again and again, it opens us to appreciate others more deeply. So Shantideva talks about this equalizing self and others. We also talk about equanimity, but equanimity is more like we have the same kind of emotional response to different people. That would be like equanimity. So if we're loving all beings, if we're loving one, we love all. That's like equanimity. A kind of impartiality and a kind of emotional quality, but equalizing self and other is a little bit more than equanimity. It's more like seeing that there's really no fundamental difference between self and other. So this is starting with verse 90 in chapter 8 of Shantideva. He says, strive at first to meditate upon the sameness of yourself and others. In joy and sorrow, all are equal. Thus, be guardian of all as of yourself. So, particularly, others are the same as us in that everyone, not just people, all so-called sentient beings, as far as we can tell, it looks like they want basic happiness. And they basically want to be free from suffering. Of course, depends on the type of person and type of species, what kind of happiness they might want. It might be very basic or it might be quite complex. But well-being, it's like part of what it is to be a sentient being, is to want to move in the direction of well-being and happiness, and want to move away from suffering and pain, want to be free from discontent. So in joy and sorrow, all are equal. Thus be the guardian of all as of yourself. The hand and the other limbs of the body are many and distinct, but all are one, the body to be kept and guarded. Likewise, different beings in their joys and sorrows are, like me, all one in wanting happiness. So, the different parts of the body don't discriminate, like, this hand is more important than this foot. Something like that, right? They're all parts of one body. So here he's comparing all sentient beings are like part of one body of life. and therefore I will dispel the pain of others, for it is simply pain, just like my own. And others I will aid and benefit, for they are living beings like my body. Read that line. It's simply pain. It's simply suffering. It's not like it's mine. It's not that it's so important whether it's mine or yours. It's more like that it's kind of impersonal in a way, right? There's just this suffering that's the same that for all beings. The suffering always has the location of a sentient being, it seems like. But the main point is like we're alleviating suffering. That's the Bodhisattva vow. It's simply pain. Since I and other beings both in wanting happiness are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us that I should strive to have my bliss alone? Since I and other beings both in fleeing suffering are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us that I should save myself and not the others? Of course, sounds easy at first. I mean, it makes sense, basically. Well, why is our suffering more important than others? But to actually, you know, let that sink into our heart, I think is very challenging. I mean, this is the way we're set up as human beings, to experience the self as individual and as most important. That's how we got here, at the kind of top of this evolutionary ladder. Survival of the fittest, survival of those who put themselves first. So this is deep in our like genetic structure. No small matter to undo. But through contemplating, I mean, this is I think what Buddhadharma is recommending and Shantideva too, contemplating over and over again the kind of the logic behind this and how it doesn't make that much sense when we really think about it. Apart from our genetic programming, it doesn't make that much logical sense that we should take care of ourselves, especially put ourself as one person over like thousands of people, which we naturally do. Suffering has no possessor, therefore no distinctions can be made in it. Since pain is pain, it is to be dispelled. What use is there in drawing boundaries? So I think this again points to this teaching that suffering has no possessor. It's not really that there's some self that has the suffering. Therefore, we can't really make distinctions about my suffering and your suffering. That's kind of arbitrary, actually. Since pain is pain, it is to be dispelled. Doesn't matter whose it is. What's the use? What use is there in drawing boundaries between my pain and your pain? The ocean-like immensity of joy arising when all beings will be freed, will this not be enough? Will this not satisfy? The wish for my own freedom, what is that to me? In other words, if we can imagine the joy if we were able to help all beings be free from suffering, that joy is way, way greater than just like me being free from my suffering, right? So when I imagine that ocean-like immensity of joy, won't that be enough? Even if I'm not completely free, and therefore the goal or the direction of my life, wouldn't it be more joyful, actually, to live to free all beings? The work of bringing benefit to beings will not, then, make me proud and self-admiring. The happiness of others is itself my satisfaction. I do not expect another recompense. So, this is a little reminder, I'm a bodhisattva working for the benefit of all beings, isn't that great? We don't need that kind of like good feeling that I'm doing so well, that kind of extra pride, the happiness of others is much happier than the pride of me helping them. Of course, but yet, so easy to forget these points. Just as hands and the other limbs are thought of as members of a body, can we likewise not consider others as the limbs and members of a living whole? We're one mind, one life, one living whole with various appendices like the appearance of me and you. But that's kind of arbitrary. Just as in connection with this form, devoid of self, my sense of I arose through strong habituation, why should not the thought of I through habit not arise related to another? In other words, thinking, when I think I, and I think of me here as this individual self, that way of thinking that we all have from very, very early on, if not birth, soon after, that arose through habituation. We kept saying I over and over until we really, really believe that there's me here separate from you and more important than you. This arose through habituation. So then why should not the thought of I through further habituation called practice not arise related to another? In other words, can I train my mind to think of I as all of us, or to think of this larger self? I might be like, well, I don't know. We're like playing with like genetics and evolution and stuff. This is going pretty far if we really change our perception like that. But I think that's the proposal of these great ancient bodhisattvas. This is actually, maybe it takes a long, long time, but the mind is very, very flexible. This is part of the good news, is that we might feel like my habits are so deeply entrenched, how could they ever change? But in fact, they can change, yeah. But it's not easy. And, from Shanti Deva's point of view, it might be like, it's first understanding this different way of thinking about all of us as one body, and then rethinking it again and again and again and again. We might say, but isn't that just kind of conceptual? Yes, but if we don't, I don't think it's just going to automatically happen. Some might say, well, in Zazen, don't we kind of dissolve the boundaries in Zazen? I think so, to some extent. And maybe that's a question of if we had never even heard about no separation between self and other, and we just let go of our thinking over and over again in Zazen, then would that same understanding dawn on us? Maybe, but maybe very slowly, more slowly than if we combine Zazen with remembering again and again. Mindfulness can also be called remembering. So we have all these verses and chants and things like this that we do over and over to remind us. So this is a little commentary on these verses of Shantideva. Although they have no ultimate grounds for doing so, all beings think in terms of I and mine. We all think, this is me and this is my book. I bought it, after all, therefore it's mine. There's no grounds for doing this, but we do it anyway. Because of this, we have a strong conception of other fixated on as something alien, although this too has no basis in reality. Aside from being merely mental imputations, I and other are totally unreal. They're both illusory. Moreover, when the non-existence of I is realized, the notion of other also disappears, for the simple reason that other is only posited in relation to the thought of I. Can you follow that? I think that's worth, you know, like, looking more deeply into that. Well, even if there's no I, there still seems to be others, but actually other is completely relative to I. So if we really don't see I as like a separate being, then we really don't see others. They go together completely. Just as it is impossible to cut the sky in two with a knife, when the space-like quality of selflessness, meaning like there's no self and no other, is realized, it is no longer possible to make a separation between I and other, and there arises an attitude of wanting to protect others as oneself and taking them as one's own. So this compassionate attitude of the Bodhisattva arises from this insight, is the proposal here. And I really appreciate this verse. Just as it's impossible to cut the sky in two with a knife, when the space-like quality of selflessness is realized, it's no longer possible to cut the separation between me and you. Right? Like right now, it seems like there is a division between me and you. I'm here and you're over there. I can easily cut that with a knife. But when the space-like quality of me and you is realized, then that space between us can't be cut. It would be like cutting sky with a knife. There's nothing there to cut, right? It seems like maybe right now, well, how are we gonna eliminate this division between me and you? We need like a really sharp saw or a high power chainsaw, and we're gonna have to chop away at this division between me and you for countless lifetimes. That's how it might seem, something like that in our imagination. But when we see the space-like quality of me and you, then there's nothing even to cut between us. There isn't anything between us except space. And you can't cut the sky in two with a knife. Now, I think this maybe does take a long time, but that's just my like limited little view about like me and time and how long things take. So I was surprised to see here that this commentator, is a great disciple of Shantideva, says, moreover, a long period of habituation in this new way of thinking is not necessary for this kind of experience to occur. Take, for example, a horse that's put up for sale. This is, maybe we'd say now like a car, right? But in like all Tibet, you know, it's horses. So this is horse put up for sale. Right up to the moment when the deal is struck, if the horse lacks grass or water, or if it's ill, or if it has any other discomfort, all this will be unbearable for its owner, while it will not at all affect the client. And if it's ill, I'm not going to buy it, actually. It's your horse to take care of. You own it, and that owner feels responsible. But as soon as the transaction takes place, it's the buyer who will be unable to stand the horse's suffering, while the seller will be completely indifferent. Maybe not completely indifferent if they were close to that horse. They maybe wish it well-being. But you can see where this is going. About the kind of sudden change that can happen. Within the horse itself, there is no basis whatever for the distinction this person's horse or that person's horse. It is identified as being this person's or that person's according to how it's labeled by thought. Right? So it's just a conventional agreement that that was your horse, now it's my horse. It's a conceptual construction, but that we, without any conscious decision, we immediately and unconsciously just, you know, change our whole emotional take on the horse as soon as we pay the money for it. I think this is true with any ownership too, right? Like a car, right? You look at a car at the dealership, it's just like one of the other cars. But as soon as you like pay for it, you have a completely different relationship to it, right? Because it's mine. In the same way, there's not the slightest reason for saying that the notion of I must be applied to me and not to another. I and other are no more than a matter of conceptual labeling. The I of myself is other for someone else, and what's other for myself is I for another. The notions of here and there are simply points of view designated by the mind in dependence on each other. There's no such thing as an absolute here or there, right? For me, this is here and that's there, but for you, that's here and this is there. In just the same way, there is no absolute I and no absolute other. It's just a matter of conceptual imputation. So we might say, well, the stakes are a little bit higher. This is a much bigger thing than here and there. We're talking about self and others. But again, you can contemplate this for a while. Maybe it's really not different than these other examples of here and there and that owner's horse versus now my horse. I think it's just the hardest thing to do this kind of little game with, right? Is me and you. It's the root of all the other ownership issues, is the sense of me. But if we understand it's really our conceptual designations, there's not really a me separate from you. There's part of our perceptual workings that relate to the world through this body and mind, yes. And that's a big reason why we do this conceptual imputation from a very young age. But we're doing something extra besides just the perception coming through these sense organs over here. We're adding something extra to the proposal. And therefore, maybe difficult, but possible to just change our way of seeing this, or at least loosen it up a little, either gradually or, as this teacher says, a long period of habituating the mind this way is not really necessary. You can immediately sell yourself to the other, like the horse, and immediately, okay, I'm yours now, and you're mine, and this distinction is not as valid as it was. Not to say that it's easy, though. So, then some, you know, real-life applications of this kind of thing. One modern Australian philosopher I really appreciate is Peter Singer. He's like an ethics professor. And has many great books, and he's really teaches ethics in I think some universities in Australia. And partly what strikes me about him is he takes his philosophy seriously. So he kind of like really examines ethics philosophy, and then sees, oh wow, the way I usually think about things actually maybe is a little funny. And I like, instead of like, let's ignore that now, the class is over, it's like, well, actually, maybe this means I have to change my life. And so he's actually changed his life in these huge ways due to his investigation of reality through basically like kind of like sort of functional ethics. And two of his classic books I have here that I think are related to this topic of Shantideva. One's called Animal Liberation, maybe he's most famous for, where he brings up the arguments why people don't treat animals the same as humans, not to mention the same as themselves. But we make these, is again, these arbitrary distinctions, and we say, he goes through the case just in the first chapter, basically, about what he calls speciesism. And he says it's exactly the same principle as racism and sexism, but it's one that we often don't notice called speciesism. And the principle is basically that people make these distinctions. They say, well, men and women are not equal, and different races are not equal, and it's true, they're not equal in various ways, but they are equal in the most important ways. And even things like intelligence, we might say, well, this person deserves this because they're more intelligent. And he picks up on that one particularly because this is the one where people make the argument against animals. They're like, well, they're not as intelligent as humans, so they're not as valuable. Therefore, killing an animal is different than killing a human. And so our society just kind of like has generated that kind of unconscious belief, I think, that, well, based on what, right? And so he said, well, what is it based on? So maybe about intelligence, like, a pig or something is not as intelligent as a human, so it's not as valuable. And then he'll say, well, if you really base like the worth of a life on intelligence, then what about, say, an adult pig and a newborn infant? That actually adult pig may actually be more intelligent than the newborn infant, right? It may be like, the infant has the potential to become more intelligent than the pig, but actually in terms of worth right now, which life is worth more, the human infant or the adult pig? Oh, of course the human infant, but this is, starts pointing out that this is kind of biased. If we really start looking at our underlying beliefs, they start to fall apart. And we don't really want to do this because it brings up huge implications. So he says, what is the basis upon which we should decide the ethics of like around killing and life and so on? And he says, basically, it's around suffering and the ability to suffer, which is very similar to what Shantideva says. All sentient beings are the same in that they all want basic well-being and they all want to be free from suffering. And Shantideva uses that basic point and like, consider this, because this is the basic of the kind of ethics where we maybe start to treat all beings as ourselves. So Peter Singer says here, if a being suffers, there can be no moral justification for refusing to take that suffering into consideration. No matter what the nature of the being, the principle of equality requires that its suffering be counted equally with the like suffering, insofar as rough comparisons can be made, of any other being. If a being is not capable of suffering or of experiencing enjoyment or happiness, there's nothing to be taken into account. It doesn't matter. So often, this is where people get into these discussions of plants versus animals, right? And there's some data about, like, pretty modern data about the secret life of plants, right? Responding to various stimulus in different ways. But the reports are not completely in on this, I think. Exactly how much plants suffer. In the old Buddhist system, the Buddha in his scientific knowledge a long time ago considered that actually plants are not sentient beings. They don't have like the at least typical kind of nervous system that we have, and therefore they die. They're born and they die. They live, but they don't suffer. And now in modern times, we don't know, so let's take care of, especially big old redwood trees. And it does seem pretty clear that animals, when we get down to bacteria and amoebas and stuff, it's hard to tell whether they're actually sentient beings too, but you know. Insects, it looks like insects try to move away from suffering and death. Whether it's just instinctual programming, well, maybe ours is instinctual programming too. Do they want a kind of well-being? Do they want to live? It looks like, and definitely animals larger than insects. So the limit of sentience, using the term as a convenient, if not strictly accurate, shorthand for the capacity to suffer and or experience enjoyment, is the only defensible boundary of concern for the interests of others. To mark this boundary by some other characteristic, like intelligence or rationality, would be to mark it in an arbitrary manner. Why not choose some other characteristic, like skin color? Right. Even if they're not rational beings, do they suffer? The more rational the beings, the more they suffer, like us. We suffer when we're like thinking about the past and the future a lot. I think animals are a little more free of that than we are, but they surely suffer. And so, the racist violates the principle of equality by giving greater weight to the interests or members of his own race when there's a clash between their interests and the interests of those of another race. The sexist violates the principle of equality by favoring the interests of his own sex, or her own sex. Similarly, the speciesist allows the interests of his own species to override the greater interests of members of other species. The pattern is identical in each case. Most human beings are speciesists. And so when he first started really like looking into that, he's like, well, I guess I have to be vegetarian now. So he did change his life in that way. Here's another book by Peter Singer called The Life You Can Save. Interestingly powerful arguments. Very similar, maybe kind of like modern day Shantideva, right? Using this kind of reasoning to break down the divisions between caring for ourself over others. This is even scarier, I think. There was this experiment that someone did, and a kind of a mental experiment, a test to ask people what they would do. Here's the scenario. You're driving your vintage sedan down a country lane when you're stopped by a hiker who has seriously injured his leg. He asks you to take him to the nearest hospital. If you refuse, there's a good chance that he will lose his leg. On the other hand, if you agree to take him to the hospital, he's likely to bleed onto the seats, which you have recently and expensively restored in soft white leather. What would you do, right? And this book is full of these great examples that make me squirm. Again, most people respond that you should drive the hiker to the hospital. This suggests that when prompted to think in concrete terms about real individuals, most of us consider it obligatory to lessen the serious suffering of innocent others, even at some cost, even a high cost, to ourselves. There's lots of examples about people risking their lives to save others who are drowning and so on. And people don't think that much about it and give up a lot of their own to save another. The drowning child story, which was another one of them, is an application of this argument for aid, since ruining your shoes and being late for work aren't nearly as important as the life of a child. I guess that was, you're late, you know, someone's drowning and you're late for work. Are you going to save the child and be late? Maybe you even like, you've been late a bunch already and you'll even get fired. You know, he pushes the examples so that you, the stakes get higher and higher to test, you know, what would you do? And it's hard, because sometimes I think, oh, you know, as a bodhisattva, isn't it clear? But actually, some cases are like, I just remember right now, just seeing something on the web, someone posted this video of somebody talking about this happened to him. He was like having lunch, and I think in San Francisco, and kind of watching on a really hot summer day and watching a homeless person in the middle of the day, like across the street on the sidewalk, kind of like rolling around and kind of like moaning a little, and like they didn't look like they were doing well, and oh, they're probably just drunk, or, you know, there's so many people like that. And he just kept eating his sandwich, and eventually the person stopped moving, and I forget how exactly what happened, but I think somebody else I think walked up and checked him, realized that he wasn't breathing, called 911, and the ambulance came and the person was dead. And so he posted this thing of like, I just watched somebody die today as I ate my lunch sandwich. So these things happen, this in real life, and I think it changed his life. It's like we gotta actually like can't like let things go like this. Similarly, reupholstering a car is not nearly as big a deal as losing a leg. Ask yourself if you can deny the premises of the argument. How could suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care not be really, really bad? So now he's saying, there's these people all over the world, right, that are dying every day due to lack of food, shelter, and medical care. Think of that small boy in Ghana who died of measles. How would you feel if you were his mother or father watching helplessly as your son suffers and grows weaker? You know that children often die from this condition. You also know that it would be curable if only you could afford to take your child to a hospital. In those circumstances, you would give up almost anything for some way of ensuring your child's survival. Putting yourself in the place of others, like the parent of that boy or the child, is what thinking ethically is all about. So, then he brings up, basically, actually, through, you know, research and stuff, you can save a child's life any moment, sometimes with just like a few dollars, by donating it to these agencies that actually will save as many as they can, depending on how many donations they get. And so then he proceeds this book to say, like, you know, when you like buy a bottle of water, for example, you're choosing to let a child die instead of that $2. Like, kind of through this kind of like sort of ethical and logical argument. And you might say, wait a second. But in fact, it's a powerful argument, enough that he himself like changed his whole life, and set up this whole organization called The Life You Can Save, where they research the most efficient way that these aid organizations around the world can help beings, and then kind of recommending that you can donate part of your income. And it, you know, if you do the argument to its total conclusion, you could say, well, we shouldn't really have anything more than the starving children, or it's like a little bit unethical. And I think he kind of says it's kind of true, but even he himself and most of us are just, we're just not willing to go that far, even though it's, there's some truth to it. And maybe there are, you know, people like Jesus and Buddha who basically did do that, maybe based on that principle. They had nothing more than anyone else. So it's kind of painful to feel that. And still, he says, but let's be reasonable. Like, actually, if everybody donated, and he's changed the numbers around. I think for a while he was at 5% of your income, which could be quite a lot, but I think he's gotten down to 1% of your income to these very efficient organizations that don't have a lot of overhead, that's going really directly into these, saving these people. That if everybody in these kind of first world countries did that, it could actually completely eliminate world poverty. He said, well, not everybody will, so maybe you donate more. And again, it's moved me. He's got a thing where you can take the pledge on his website and see, along with all these others who've contribute some percentage. And so it's kind of how much we let these kind of ideas. These are kind of conceptual ideas too, right? These are conceptual imputations, just like self and other. But do we see if there's some, if we feel some like deeper truth, do we let them actually sink into us? I think this is the scary part, both with Peter Singer's books. I hope he doesn't write any others. and with people like Shantideva and the Dharma. In general, I think if we really let it sink in deeply, it's kind of problematic. Because either we feel like a little like off from, like my life is not aligned with my deepest values. I feel that way. I feel hypocritical in many ways. And how is that to feel hypocritical? In a way, actually, for myself, it's kind of sweet, actually. It sounds kind of funny. I feel a little, kind of some warmth about feeling so hypocritical. What is that? I think it's because it's like I'm aware of more of how reality is functioning. And even though I'm not quite in line with it, I'd like to move in that direction, and I'd like to be open to reality, even if it's painful. Even though ignorance is bliss. From a Dharma point of view, wisdom or ending ignorance is more blissful, even if it's painful. I don't know if that makes sense, but I mean, I'm just checking in with myself in the moment and seeing, like, would I rather not think about these things and not feel hypocritical? I think, no, actually, I'm okay feeling hypocritical. So, anyway, that's a scary talk. Let's get out of here. Quick, let's think about something else. What's for tea? Yes.
Just a comment that it's not as serious as what you were just talking about, which I think really is an incredibly important precept that we have, has to be thought about all the time. How to simplify our lives, what it means for the rest of the world, and so forth, what we have to give. I just feel like every time we have discussion about oneness, I want to include in it the idea that individuality doesn't have to include ownership or identity.
That's right.
You know, that we have to balance the sense of diversity, love it, respect it, and carry that along with the idea that we also don't own it and we respect it and we see it as ourselves in terms of how we treat it.
Yeah.
But it's not the same. You know, no snowflake is the same, no person.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's the beauty of life.
That's the beauty.
Yeah, and also, even going further than just seeing, well, there's no ownership, but there's still, like, you know, it's so nice that, you know, I have a body and you have a body so we can dance together.
Exactly.
That wouldn't, you know, that's part of the joy. But you could say even more, I think, because we have conventions of ownership, like we have a precept of not stealing, for example, which is kind of based on a delusion in a way, right? On a deeper level. So we steal, but we honor this, the conventions that, like, because I don't think they're going to disappear anytime soon, that the world, you know, believes in. And, you know, we were talking about the other day, some of us, like, you have a contract, you buy a house or a car or something, you have a piece of paper that this means you own it. But that's so arbitrary, right? it's just an agreement that we, as a society, we agree on. I think it came up maybe in the discussion about the Native Americans who had different agreements, right? And so the Europeans have these piece of paper agreements, so then they say, well, we own this land now, see? And the natives, huh? That's a piece of paper. But still, we within our conventional society, the bodhisattva way is to kind of like accord with beings. What, you know, it's sort of, we have that middle way. We're according with beings and the structures of society, and at the same time we're maybe like questioning them too. As Dharma practitioners, we're also kind of like Peter Singer and Shantideva. We can also kind of poke a little about, well, is really I and other really just conceptual designations? Anything else? Yes.
One of the things that came up for me as you were describing the way of the Bodhisattva according to Shantideva was I was thinking a lot about parenting, and that, you know, the big paradox is that part of raising a child is there's an individuation process where you're teaching or you're helping the child develop a sense of self.
Yes.
And the paradox is how to teach this that there is no separation.
Yeah.
You see where I'm going?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that the standard take on that is that for this Dharma work of dissolving the boundaries between self and other, you have to have a nice, good, solid, grounded sense of self first. And so I think it's part of the setup in this world system is that the children's, I think they do have to learn that completely, you know. And then you could say that's part of the fun. It's like, learn it completely, and then if you want to later in your life, you can start deconstructing it. It's not exactly going back to though before you learn the individuation. I think as practitioners, bodhisattvas, it's more subtle than that. So also we always have the two truths, you know, the ultimate truth of no separation between self and other, and the conventional or seeming truth of the appearance of difference between self and other. And they always go together and they can never be separated. If you deny the conventional truth, you also deny the ultimate truth, actually. So it's not a matter of there just is no self in other, period. No, it's both. It's right in the interaction of self and other that a bodhisattva could recognize that these are conceptual designations, that the mind is creating this illusion and still have a conversation and still help alleviate suffering. Because ultimately suffering is an illusion too. So if the bodhisattvas take the really ultimate stance on suffering, then they won't be able to work for the benefit of beings because there aren't any real beings and there isn't any real suffering, so what's the problem? And that's not the bodhisattva path. So it's that very subtle that we could talk about forever, and probably will, non-duality of the two truths. Completely engaged in living with others and the nitty-grittiest details of exactly how we're going to work out every little bit of our relationship, and at the same time all that's happening in vast space that can't be cut up with a knife. Thanks for bearing with these challenging teachings and for giving me the chance to challenge myself and reinvigorate my sweet feeling of hypocrisy. We dedicate this merit to all living beings everywhere. May they be totally free. Be